Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, the day of each week that we venture down into the vault and retrieve an older episode of the show for you. This one originally published on March 29th, 2022, and it's part one of our series called The Three-Pupiled Eye.
Yeah, I remember this one being quite a lot of fun, and I think we discussed this idea as it pops up in various cultures and traditions and sources, but I think we do get a little bit into some Irish legend, so it's a good topic to revisit as we launch ourselves towards St. Paddy's Day.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And, you know, we recently did a couple of episodes that related to Irish mythology. And as we were, you know, looking through these various accounts of various heroes and monsters and tales of Tuatha De Danann and so forth, I was reminded again of a motif that I remember coming up briefly, at least when we were looking at the hero Cú Chulainn, and that is Irish heroes that are depicted as having either multiple pupils or multiple irises within their eyes.
That is a strange detail, especially because I can picture multiple pupils. I have a harder time picturing multiple irises. So, of course, Basic anatomical note, the pupil is the black dot in the middle of your eye, and the iris is the colored ring around that dot. So multiple pupils, I'm seeing, okay, multiple dots. Multiple irises, I don't know. That just, what, like, how would you tell where one iris began or ended?
Well, I guess you'd have to have, like, multiple irises and pupils in that department. And as we'll get into, one of the things is that some of these accounts will say pupils and other versions of that same account will say irises. So, I'm not sure exactly how, the term maybe gets confused over time, or it's lost in translation. And it kind of adds to the mystery of not being exactly sure what we're talking about here when these details come up.
Well, so how do these details go? Like, what's an example?
Okay, so taking for example Cú Chulainn, since we've discussed him before, the Irish hero, a warrior hero, a demigod, possessed by the ability to enter the warp spasm during battle. Lots of wonderful tales about this character, and he's prominently featured in the early Irish epic, the Cattle Raid of Cooley, or the Táinne, as it's sometimes called. But one of the other interesting facts about this hero is that he is sometimes described as having seven irises. As translated from the epic by Joseph Dunn, this is, I believe, a 1914 translation, quote, seven jewels of the eye's brilliance was either of his kingly eyes, seven toes to either of his 2 feet, seven fingers to either of his 2 hands, with the clutch of hawk's claw, with the grip of hedgehog's talon in every separate one of them.
I love how that's all majestic and fierce until you get to the hedgehog.
I don't know. A hedgehog's talon sounds pretty intense to me, even if I can't quite picture what that would be.
Maybe I don't have enough experience with hedgehogs. Though I also, this struck me because I love stories where beings have a strange, recurring, specific number of body features. It reminds me of visions in the Bible, like particularly the visions of the dragon and the beast in the Book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not familiar, the Book of Revelation is the last book in the Christian New Testament. It is mostly describing a vision that the author, someone named John, says was given to him by Christ. And it's a book where the number seven has great significance. It's used in a number of ways throughout the apocalypse. There are messages sent to seven church congregations there. And then within the vision, seven seals are opened, seven trumpets are sounded, and so forth. But there are also these wondrous beings, both great and terrible, with seven of something. So for example, in chapter 12, verse 3, it says, "And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads." And I always wondered if that meant, okay, so he's got 7 heads and then 7 crowns on his heads, but does that mean 7 crowns per head or just 1 crown per head? I'm not sure.
One of the 7 heads is wearing 7 crowns stacked on top of each other. That head's a real dick.
They fight over the crowns. But then later also, the beast is said to have 7 heads and 10 horns, quote, "and upon his horns, 10 crowns, and upon his heads, the name of blasphemy." And so I like these specific numbers. It's not just like, oh, this beast has 2 heads. It's got 7 heads. And of course, in Jewish and Christian traditions, 7 is a very significant number. It's a holy number, and one that most of the time seems to be associated with wholeness or completion or fulfillment. You know, God rested on the 7th day in the creation story after creating mm-hmm. earth in 6 days, rested on the 7th. So it's sort of like the finishing of a good and wholesome cycle of something. Though I guess in this case, it's interesting because this is a sort of unholy 7. It's the opposite of God. And there are other beings in Jewish literature described with various specific numbers of features. For example, there is a vision described in the Book of Isaiah where the prophet sees the Lord sitting upon a throne and he's surrounded by angels called seraphim, which literally means the burning ones. And the seraphim are said to each have 6 wings. And there's a reason given for this in the vision. The wings are each doing something. So Isaiah says that with 2 of the wings, he covered his face. With 2 of them, he covered his feet. And with the other 2, he did fly. Though I wonder if the number 6 is also showing a different significance in that these beings are sort of the second highest beings in the heavenly hierarchy without being on the level of God himself. So 7 is holy perfection and fulfillment, 6 is one level under that.
Oh, wow. So first of all, I love how this actually is finding a way to tie back to our recent episodes on the days of the week, you know, the 7-day week. And yeah, all these, there's something about examples like this where we're dealing with, you know, literary motifs and symbolism and, you know, mythic beings. But we take these non-biological numbers and they sort of bleed through their imagined bodies. And
yeah.
and we instantly enter this zone of fantasy and myth. It's the sort of thing that I think, you know, today we would classify this sort of thing as like, you know, visionary art or, you know, some sort of a psychedelic notion. But clearly we've been dreaming up these things throughout human history.
Well, yeah. And you're right to note that 7 is not a very biological number. Yeah. I mean, usually in animals with bilateral symmetry, there tend to be even numbers of things. There are some interesting exceptions, but that's most often the case. We'll get to one exception within the human body later on that I like. So I don't know exactly why you'd get these myths later on of like, say, yeah, a hero who's got 7 irises in his eye or 7 pupils in his eye. But I would be surprised if it isn't part of a tradition, if it isn't all downstream from this ancient line of thinking that says, hey, you know, this monster doesn't just have two heads, it has seven heads. And not only does it have seven heads, the fact that it has seven heads means something. This is like the ultimate bad monster because there's seven of it. Seven is kind of like a siren. It means whenever there's seven or of something, it's incredibly meaningful. It's intensely significant.
Mm-hmm. And with Cucullin's eye, it's really hard for me to picture it. Like, I guess I end up picturing like this just sort of ring of pupils. And then, yeah, when I try and picture seven irises in there, it doesn't really come together for me. Here are a couple of other translations. Thomas Kinsella translation says, seven hard heroic jewels are set in the iris of Cucullin's eye. And then Dunn also translating another section of the work here from a poem, Prophecy, quote, seven gems of champions brave deck the center of his orbs. Naked are the spears he bears, and he hooks a red cloak round. And I've seen these. Yeah, I've seen these described as pupils, as irises. And there's one version that reads, quote, there were seven pupils in Cucullin's royal eye, and two of these pupils were squinting.
The pupils were squinting.
Yes, and this is another area where I haven't found much to really, you know, break down what this means, and that just makes it more enticing. Like what? Imagine looking into this hero's eyes, and then like first of all, there are like seven pupils in there. Uh-huh. And then to make things even weirder, to make that moment even weirder, two of them are squinting at you.
Two of the pupils are squinting. So pupils do, of course, contract. We'll talk about that as we go on. That's one of their main anatomical functions. But I don't think that's usually what people mean with the word squinting. With squinting, I think of squeezing of like the muscles around the orbital, you know, your face.
Yeah, though, as we'll discuss, pupils do weird things. So maybe by the time we roll through some examples from the animal world, we'll have a better idea of what this could conceivably look like. But Cucullin is not the only character in Irish tradition who has mysterious eyes. There's also a character by the name of Fedelm, or I think the modern version of this is Fedelma. And she's a member of the Tuatha De Danann. She's a prophet, a poet. She's mentioned in the Ulster Cycle. And I've also read that some critics and historians think that she may be connected to later traditions of the Banshee, which, again, the Banshee, one of its whole things is that it is it haunts a place, it wails in anticipation of death. So it is in its own way a prophet, though a prophet of one particular thing.
Hmm.
She appears in the Táin as well, and she is described as having three irises in each eye, triple irises. And this gets really interesting because she's described at length, and I'm just going to read a part of it translated by Dunn. Quote, weaving lace was she, and in her right hand was a bordering rod of silvered bronze with its seven strips of red gold at the sides. A many-spotted green mantle around her, a bulging strong-headed pin of gold in the mantle over her bosom, a hooded tunic with red interweaving about her, a ruddy fair-faced countenance she had, narrow below and broad above. She had a blue-gray and laughing eye. Each eye had three pupils. Dark and black were her eyebrows. The soft black lashes threw a shadow to the middle of her cheeks. Red and thin were her lips. Shiny and pearly were her teeth. Thou wouldst believe they were showers of white pearls that had rained into her head. And I have to say, I love how... I mean, it's all beautiful, but the three pupils in the eye just gets like this brief description. But then the author's like, and let me tell you about her teeth.
Right. Yeah. I had the same reaction. Though then again, I'm thinking about the historical setting from which this story would have emerged. And maybe at that time, seeing somebody with really clean teeth was even more rare than an eye with three pupils.
True. So we already have a couple of examples here. Cucullin, and we also have Fedelm here. And Fedelm is very much a seer. She has eyes of prophecy. So it's easy to see where one interpretation here is that her eyes are unnatural because she has unnatural vision. She can see into the future. Makes sense, right?
Sure.
But as several different commentators have pointed out, this is another level where it got even more interesting, is that commentators have pointed out that these are also signs of beauty. So think to this passage I just read. So, yes, again, she is a seer, but she's described as not being beautiful, but possessed with weird eyes. Her triple pupils or irised eyes are listed as part of her beauty. Though, you know, undeniably this connects to her attributed powers as well.
Right. So it's listed along other things like having long lustrous eyelashes and pearly teeth, things that in a lot of other literature would be just clear markers that are supposed to mean beauty. And here it's also like, and three people died. That is one of those things, right? We all know that thing.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, I think, something that makes it so fascinating to read as a modern reader of the text. Because obviously, if you had a modern work of fiction that was referring to a character like this, everything would go in reverse, right? You would have you would say, oh, she was beautiful and she looked totally human, a beautiful human, except, whoa, those eyes, three pupils in each one. It was a bit weird. So one of the sources that I was looking at about this is Jacqueline Borst's The Evil Eye in Early Irish Literature and Law, 2003, published in Celtica 24. It provides a lot of insight into the literary motif of the eye in Irish literature. So she brings up, first of all, a different creature with a unique eye, and that is the one-eyed giant Ingsoll Cash, or Ingsoll the Terrible, who is described as this great giant, something of a pirate, I think with possible like English origins of the time. So, you know, in this we get like the idea that if there is some sort of historical basis for this figure, maybe he was just some sort of a pirate raider from that region. But in the mythic connotation, he becomes this great big giant who not only has just this single eye in his head, he's not only a cyclops, but it is a solid black eye, and that solid black eye has seven pupils within it. Though I've also read descriptions where he just has three pupils.
How would it have pupils if it's solid black? The pupil is the black part of the eye, so that's thoroughly confusing.
Yes. So he's known for the destruction of the Durga Hostel. There's a whole story about this. And so the author here is discussing Ingsoll's eye, and she connects it not only with Cú Chulainn, but also with the High King of Ireland, Cormac MacArt, who is also said to have had seven pupils in each eye.
Wow.
So again, it's just driving home that this is a recurring motif. It's not like a one-time thing that, you know, it clearly meant something and was worth repeating in the canon. But she points out that, in the cases of these two heroes, quote, this is explicitly qualified as a sign of beauty. And furthermore, she says that the squinting in Cú Chulainn's pupils is also seen as adornment rather than disfigurement. And then she also comes back to Fedelm, the female seer of the Tuatha De Danann, and says, quote, there is no explanation offered of this characteristic, the triple eye with Fedelm. It could be a sign of beauty, and it could be a sign of her supernatural sight. The latter is more probable because the characteristic is separated from the description of her looks by the mention of the weaver's beam. The weaver's beam has been interpreted as a supernatural tool for prophecy. The triple pupils could therefore very well be a symbol of her clairvoyance. And so if I'm not mistaken here, the weaver's beam, this is part of a loom. So we're getting into the idea that, like, here, this piece of technology also had mystical connotations for divination.
All right, what about Ingsoll, though, the giant or pirate who has a single eye, which is entirely black, and also has either three or seven pupils in it?
Well, she says that, okay, if we're going to look at these other examples and try and figure out Ingsoll, we'll say, first of all, he's definitely not beautiful. This is not a sign of his beauty. He's a rough and horrible monster. She points out some of the terms that are used to describe him. But his sight is described as being sharp. He can make out every detail of the hostel at a glance. And Borst says that he also might connect to the legendary evil eye of Balor, the king of the Fomorians, whose great great eye when opened and when his great brow could be raised up. In some accounts, two warriors have to stand on either side of him, put a wooden beam beneath his big saggy brow and lift the brow up so that the evil eye can see out and unleash destruction on the battlefield. It could be connected to that. Balor, by the way, is eventually killed by his grandson, Lug, of the Tuatha De Danann. And there are multiple versions of the Balor myth as well. Sometimes his destructive eye is described, you know, more or less like the single eye of a cyclops. And other times it's depicted as more of a third eye in the center of the head alongside two ordinary eyes. So there's just a taste of the triple or sevenfold eye in Irish mythology. And again, researched it a bit and laid it out in the outline here, it's still just overwhelmingly mysterious and awe-inspiring to me. And we're going to come back to some other traditions, some other ancient writings that refer to mysterious eyes of this nature. But at this point, we're gonna shift into the scientific world. And hopefully this will be a fun case where the science and the myth will sort of play off each other, and each one will make the other more fabulous. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Well, since we're talking about eyes, I think we do need to do a quick overview of eyeball anatomy. So picture an eyeball. Rob, are you doing it? Can you see that eyeball in your mind's eye?
Burning like the eye of Sauron.
Okay, well, that actually connects to something, because the Eye of Sauron, you picture that's not just floating out in space, right? It's sitting in a tower.
That's right.
And so, of course, our eyeballs need some structural scaffolding as well. So the eyeball of a human sits within a bony socket called the orbit. And the outer layer of the eyeball itself is a tough white tissue made of collagen that's called the sclera. This is the white part of the eye that you can see. And then the pupil, of course, is the black dot in the middle of the eye. Covering the pupil on the outside is a clear layer of cells known as the cornea, which both protects the eye, it protects the iris and the pupil, and it also helps to focus incoming light into the pupil. Actually, there are two parts of your eyes that do focusing of light rays. The cornea does the majority of it. I think it does about 2/3 of the focusing, and that's the first layer. And actually, if you've listened to our episodes on tears that we did, I think, a couple of months ago, you know, there's something even to the outside of the cornea, which is that thin layer of tear film that covers the eye. It's secreted by the lacrimal glands. Well, actually, it has multiple parts. The watery part of the tear film is secreted by the lacrimal glands. And then there's an oily part of the tear film that comes from the base of the eyelids. Now, coming to the pupil, while it's tempting to think of the pupil as a thing, the interesting truth is that the pupil is really an absence. The pupil is the hole or the opening through which light passes. So light comes through the cornea and then is directed through the pupil and then is focused again a second time after the cornea by a clear structure on the inside of the eye, the inside of the pupil, that's called the lens. And then finally, after it is focused through the lens, the light is reflected onto the layer of sensitive cells on the back of the inside of the eye, known as the retina. And then the sensing cells of the retina transmit the information about the light via the optic nerve all the way to the visual cortex in the back of the brain, where the information is made sense of in a way that we experience as sight. So I think what we should say is that sight happens in the brain, which is why there are so many things that can affect what we see when we look at the world. You know, it's not just like a video camera feed. There's some post-processing that goes on that can be affected by all kinds of things from biases and little tricks of how the brain works to drugs. And so, so sight happens in the brain, but of course light has to go through all these stages within the eye before it is turned into the experience of vision in the visual cortex.
You know, I was just thinking, you were talking about how, about the pupil being an absence and not a thing. And I was thinking about, there's of course the Chinese story of the magic paintbrush, and I think there are different variations on this, but there's one in which the paintbrush, whatever you paint with it comes to life, but only after you have added the eyes, or I think perhaps adding the pupil / iris of the eye, because depending on the detail of your illustration, like the pupil and the eye are just going to be one, right? Like if you're painting an eye, drawing an eye, you create the white and then you put that black dot in the middle to complete it. And it kind of brings life to something. But on the other hand, I think to the world of miniature painting, and if anyone's never seen this, you should look it up because it can be hilarious. When people are just figuring out what they're doing with miniatures, they'll often want to complete like this, you know, we're talking like a small scale, soldier or something, and they'll want to put eyes on it. So they'll create the white dots and then they'll go to throw those little black dots in there as well. Often with just hilarious results. You'll end up with just the completely ridiculous googly eyes that look too big for the head, and one eye's put looking off in one direction and the other in another direction. But we have that compulsion. It's not real until I add the pupil iris. We can't just have white there. We can't just have dark there. We have to have both.
Well, yeah, I think there is actually a strong biological reason why having both is very important to us. You know, we've looked at research before on how humans are very sensitive to noticing gaze direction in other humans, to monitoring the movement of other people's eyes to understand where they're looking. That is very socially relevant information, and we keep close tabs on it, even when you don't notice you're doing it.
Yeah,
So if you're to see a representation of a human and they like don't have pupils in their eyes, this is very disturbing because it's like, well, I can't tell where they're looking. And that, you know, that doesn't feel good at all.
Yeah, this is probably why, you know, it's very popular in films and TV shows. If you need a character to have a very, very otherworldly air to them, just simply give them completely black eyes or completely white eyes. And you know, they'll have this angelic or demonic air about them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The one thing I do want to come back to, when I said that the pupils are an absence and I said not a thing, I mean, of course, it depends on what you mean by thing. But, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they are the pinhole in a pinhole camera. Right. Without the hole, the pinhole camera doesn't work. So they're very important. You've got to have them. But what they are is an opening.
Yeah.
Here's another weird thing. You ever think about the fact that your eye has muscles?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe this is one that everybody else is just fully metabolized and is sitting with them just fine. But thinking about my eye muscles makes me a little woozy. But obviously it's true. I mean, in fact, your eye has multiple levels of muscles. And here's, we're going to come back to creatures with seven of something. So arranged around the back of each of your eyes attached to the sclera, there are seven muscles known as the extraocular muscles. And these are muscles that move the eyeballs and to some degree the eyelids as well, certainly the superior eyelids. So when you look up, down, side to side, up at an angle, when you're trying to remember something, you're flexing these muscles.
Do you think Cucullin had seven of these or did he have 49 muscles on his eyeballs?
Wait, did he have different eyes? I think he only had two eyeballs. He just had seven irises or eyes. So these are apportioned according to eyeballs, not to pupils and irises.
Didn't know how deep into his anatomy the numerology went.
But to get even weirder, there are also muscles within the eye. There are muscles in your eyes responsible for changing the diameter of the pupil, of that opening. So remember, the pupil is basically a hole, and the function of the pupil is to allow light to pass through the lens and onto the retina. And the eye has to adjust the size of the hole to help control light exposure and to focus the image. A very easy example to see for yourself, everybody probably did this in elementary school at some point, but if you never did, check it out sometime. Watch your pupils in a mirror when you're turning the lights in the room on and off. Your pupil will dilate in a dark room to allow more light in, to become more sensitive to less data. And when the light comes on, the pupil will contract to allow less light in. Mm-hmm. Now, I was reading about what function the pupil serves, because I think the expansion and contraction of the pupil is not only for controlling for the amount of light in the environment. I think it also helps control focus of the image that you're trying to turn your gaze onto. So I was reading about this in a paper by Sebastian Mathot called Pupillometry, Psychology, Physiology, and Function in the Journal of Cognition 2018. And Mathot writes, quote, although pupil responses likely serve many functions, not all of which are fully understood, one important function is to optimize vision either for acuity, small pupils see sharper, and depth of field, small pupils see sharply at a wider range of distances, or for sensitivity, large pupils are better able to detect faint stimuli. And then finally says, that is, pupils change their size to optimize vision for a particular situation. And probably all of these are familiar to people who have ever had to work the aperture of a film camera. Because you manipulate the aperture not just to respond to different light conditions and to avoid overexposing or underexposing, but you also do it in order to control things like depth of field. Like, do you want, you know, things that are both close and far away in sharp focus, or only what's up close in focus, and so forth. But to come back to those muscles within the eye, what causes the expansion or contraction of the pupil is actually the set of muscles within the iris. This is what your iris is for. And so here's a wonderful anatomy fact that everyone should know. When you hear a good love song or a poem about eye color, you know, my love, how I long to gaze into your big brown eyes, the singer is technically longing to gaze into two sphincters.
Well, it certainly makes you rethink Van Morrison's Brown-Eyed Girl a bit.
Right, yes.
Speaking of which, Irish singer, why not, why brown eyes instead of triple or seven pupiled eyes? Missed opportunity.
Brown-Eyed Girl is a song all about the appreciation of beautiful glassy sphincters glinting in the sun. Okay, so the iris is composed of two types of muscle. You've got the dilator muscles, and these are long muscle fibers, relatively long, within the eye at least, that cause the pupil to expand when they contract. So you can kind of think of muscles like pulling an opening wider by pulling at its edges. And then the second type within the iris is the sphincter muscle. This is a ring of muscle tissue around the inner edge of the iris that shrinks the pupil when it contracts. And so the term sphincter is, of course, most famous for referring to the muscle that controls the anus, but it actually just means any ring of muscle that works to open and close a tube in an animal body. So you actually have multiple sphincters throughout your body, not just in the anus and the irises, but also internally controlling the openings of the stomach.
By the way, we do have, at least a couple of episodes about the evolution of the anus that we did a few years back. So if anyone is interested in more information on that, then I send you to the vault to seek those episodes out.
Oh, yeah. I recall that being great fun. But I wanted to say, believe it or not, this tidbit about sphincters is the sphincters of the eyes is not just an amusing digression. This will actually play into what I'm about to talk about, which is an extremely rare medical condition in which human beings do sometimes have multiple pupils in the same eye. And this is a condition known as polychoria. So it's very, very rare, but multiple pupils per eye does exist in the real world. And so as a source on this, I was looking at a book called The Handbook of Pediatric Neuro-Ophthalmology, published by Springer in 2006 by Kenneth W. Wright, Peter H. Spiegel, and Lisa S. Thompson. According to the authors here, there are actually two different conditions known as polychoria, though both are referring to conditions where there is more than one opening in the iris. They say these additional openings tend to be due to what they call local hypoplasia of the iris stroma and the pigment epithelium. So these are the layers of tissue within the iris. The iris stroma is the bigger middle layer, and the pigment epithelium is a layer that is what gives eyes their color, the pigment on the back of the irises. And so hypoplasia within those tissues would mean a lack of cells or an incomplete formation of the cells within those tissues. Now, regarding the two varieties of this condition, there is true polychoria, in which there is more than one pupil and they each have their own iris sphincter muscle with the ability to contract. Then there is false polychoria or pseudopolychoria, in which there are multiple openings in the iris, but only one has the sphincter muscle. So the sphincter muscle is what makes the difference. Having the sphincters around your extra pupils is what makes it true polychoria. Both conditions are rare, but true polychoria is much more rare. They write that in almost all clinical situations, the correct diagnosis is pseudopolychoria. And given how rare polychoria is, there doesn't seem to be a ton of accessible medical literature on it. Most of what I did find was pretty old. I found one report from recent years, and this was an article published in JAMA Ophthalmology from 2020 by Antoine Safi and Schallenberg and Aki Kawasaki called Polychoria in a Young Girl. This was a case report of a 9-year-old girl in good health who was in for a regular checkup with her doctor when the doctor noticed that she had two pupils in her left eye, one regular-sized pupil in the middle and then another much smaller hole in the iris just to the side of the primary. Rob, I've attached a picture for you to look at here. But this case was one of the extremely rare documented cases of true polychoria because both pupils in the same eye would contract simultaneously when exposed to light, meaning they both had functional sphincter muscles surrounding them. And one of the proposed causes of true polychoria is what the authors call, quote, a snaring or pinching off from the margin of another pupil. And that would seem to make sense of why there would be sphincter muscles surrounding it. So if you picture the pupil surrounded by this ring of sphincter muscle, and then you picture part of that pupil some kind of quirk of how the cells are growing, part of the pupil getting pinched off and separated from the other one, like the iris cells around it kind of just come together and grow together and pinch off part of it, that would still, it would still be surrounded by those sphincter muscle cells.
By the way, and a lot of times we'll say, definitely go do an image search so you can see what we're talking about here. I have to advise, if you're doing a search for polychoria, you will invariably turn up some actual images, but also a lot of doctored images and like clickbait images that don't represent anything that's actually happening in the real biological world.
If you definitely want to see a real photo, you can look up the article I just mentioned. Again, that was in JAMA Ophthalmology called Polychoria in a Young Girl. It just has close-ups of the pupils, and you can see them right there.
Yeah, these images are quite impressive. Though, of course, I have to say that anytime you have a close-up image of the inner workings of an eyeball, you're getting into weird territory because it quickly becomes this strange alien world.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Now, you might be tempted to wonder, whoa, if somebody has two pupils in the same eye, how does that affect vision? Like, do they see two images out of that eye or something? And the answer to that is no, because what's sending the light data back to your visual cortex is the retina. So what tends to result from polychoria is usually just some impairment of vision in that eye, but it doesn't tend to, at least as far as I've read, create any extravagant, unusual effects. More likely, if it has effects on vision, it's probably just some reduction in the function of the eye or impairment of vision.
I mean, you kind of come back to the same place where we've been here before, where you talk about sight, and it's something that we, you know, most of us take for granted. But then when you start thinking about what's actually happening, you know, that you have these not one but two different eyeballs functioning, and this data is then reassembled and created into this stitched together into this simulated model of the world inside our heads. It's pretty crazy.
Well, yeah, and especially because, as we said earlier, you know, vision happens in the brain. It just makes use of data gathered with the eyes. So the brain can actually do a lot of compensating, adapting, and adjusting based on what's going on in the first part of the process.
Right. It also reminds me of talking to David Eagleman. You know, one of the things he points out is that we're basically Mr. Potato Heads, and the more sensory tools that you plug into the brain, like, it's just going to be integrated into the model. So, you know, one eyeball, two eyeballs. If you were to add additional eyeballs or additional things that fed in additional data, like, that would be consolidated into the whole.
Yeah, he's pretty, from what I understand, he's pretty bullish on plasticity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there are differences of opinion among experts on this, like, how adaptable is the adult brain? How many types of new sensory information could a brain make use of? But yeah, I think he's more on the end of, like, we would be shocked how much the brain can adapt to.
Right. Yeah. But then again, just coming back to the idea that, yeah, your vision is not the thing your eye does. Your vision is the thing your brain does using the eyes.
Right.
All right, so we're going to be back in the next episode. We're going to have more ancient ideas about multi-lobed eyes. We're going to have some more science this time from the animal world and some of the strange pupils going on out there. I did want to mention, though, briefly that, yeah, you do have some pretty neat pop culture examples of multi-pupiled, multi-irised eyes. I was trying to think of them. I feel like the ones that came to mind are all kind of loosely connected to each other, or they all feel like they're very much within the same sort of genre of sort of weird horror-themed visionary art.
I was like, Rob, is it going to be Tool?
Yeah, well, it has to be Tool, right? Because I guess these were probably my first exposures to this kind of imagery, even though, again, it's clearly been around with us for a very long time. But there's Adam Jones of Tool. His art for the EP Opiate features something like, you know, eyes with multiple pupils and or eyes undergoing mitosis, or their figure eight pupils. It's, you know, hard to figure out exactly what's happening in a stationary image. There's also the Cam de Leon album art Ocular Orifice for Tool's 1996 album Anima, featuring an eye with two or more irises and pupils. And that's one that I believe is animated as well. So it gets this, you get this idea of the eye turning.
Was that an album that had some release where you'd, like, turn it in the light and it would move?
Yeah, you could. Okay. Yeah, some of the images could be placed so that they're looking out the front of the CD case and it creates this movement. That's real, like, masters of the physical release.
The horror movie you talked about with the VHS box with light up eyes.
Yeah, they were very very much in that. I mean, they're still putting out albums with that kind of gimmickry, which I love. Now, a film that comes to mind. There's John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, which I know you saw in the last few years anyway. There's scene in which a deranged killer crashes through the storefront, this cafe front, with an axe, and then you get a close-up of his eyes, and he seems to have, they're either like conjoined irises or perhaps irises that are undergoing mitosis that are coming together or splitting apart or something is going on there, and it's like a super creepy moment. And then he starts talking about Sutter Kane. And then, of course, you know, that's a film that's often talked about in terms of Lovecraftian influences. There's a great madness line at the end of H.P. Lovecraft's story, The Haunter of the Dark, that reads, "I see it coming here, hell, wind, titan blur, black wings, Yog-Sothoth save me, the three-lobed burning eye."
I mean, frankly, after all this talk of seven-lobed burning eyes, I feel like that's rather lame.
It's not that impressive. I can easily imagine the three-lobed burning eye, but seven-lobed, that's too mad to even write about.
Yog-Sothoth arrives on Earth after millions of years, is like, "I have come to conquer," runs into Cucullin, and then Cucullin's like, "I have so many more irises than you." And
that's right. Yeah, I mean, Cucullin could totally whip Yog-Sothoth, no question about it. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it out there, but we will be back Thursday. There'll be more eye-related wonder, more eye-related science. So tune in. In the meantime, we'd love to hear from everyone, though. If you have thoughts about this episode, if you have thoughts about Irish mythology, other tales that involve multiple pupils or multiple irises in the same eye. Like I say, we're going to mention some in the next episode, but it's very likely. I mean, I'm definitely missing something. There's some sort of detail from some other folklore, mythology, or certainly pop culture. And we would love to hear about any of those examples. So write in and let us know. Those episodes, of course, core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, come out on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Wednesday, we do a short form artifact or monster fact. On Monday, we do listener mail. And on Friday, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious matters and just discuss a strange film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Constantly making trips to Home Depot? Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you for every shopping trip. Earn free gift cards for shopping. Download the Drop app now and use code DROP33 to get $5 in points.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.